I've heard some silly talk going around here.
Silly talk?
I've heard some real silly talk. They're saying that we should be worried in the war games, and I think that's pretty silly. Anybody with a half a brain, Michael, can take a look at their television set right now, and you tell me, baby, look into that tube, and you look like us, would you be worried? No, 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 no. We don't care, do we? No, 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 no. Michael, tell them how we feel, will you, please?
First of all, we don't have to care. The reason we don't have to care is we got what you want. And you know what you can do? You can, one hand, do what you know else in the other, and see which one fills up first, boys. Because sitting right beneath us is the savage beast that came across on the boat. No, they didn't let him on no jet airliner. No, they didn't let him on no Silver Eagle. They paddled across on a boat, and they've been going in your face, road warriors, and they've gone down and ripped your heart right out. And then the Midnight Express, the most technical team in professional wrestling, has had technical breakdowns.
There you
go. And then, who could forget Dr. Death? The meanest, awesome man in professional wrestling until the sight of Terry Bam Bam Gordy. Understand this. We go in the outdoor. We go up the downstairs. We are in and out of trouble. We're the talk of the town. And we get wild in the streets when the sun goes down. And the sun is set. And it's time for a war. You understand? They say, whoa, good God, Joe, what is it good for? Tell them what it's good for.
Let me say it just like this. You know, we're going to end. We're going to end the war. Because we got the bomb. And tonight, we're going to drop the bomb on Baltimore, Maryland. And it's going to explode right through your television set.
You understand that, warriors? Midnight and Dr. Death, the whole thing has come to an end.
We're going to drop the bomb tonight.
Welcome to Review Away, everyone. John Volek joined by Wei Ting. We are here at the Fight Network Studios, and Wei, I love this. What? I don't know who thought of this idea of putting a giant Fight Network sign on the glass, but I love it. No, I feel like we have privacy in here.
Yeah, the glass window that looks out from this studio, the glass window that we constantly see.
Where we saw Kevin Sullivan, where we've seen people literally, like, blow the window with their mouths on.
Yeah, yeah. That window has been completely shut now because of this Fight Network sign. So
fantastic.
Complete privacy.
Yeah. I also like it too because, like, sometimes I'd be in here doing, like, an interview and people would just walk in, even with the red light on. Uh-huh. For some reason now, you don't have that problem because it's, well, I don't know what's going on in there, so I'm just going to leave it.
Right, right.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Big, big fan of this sign.
Yeah. Any type of isolation for John Pollock, he will be happy with.
All right. We're alluding to too much visual because... Oh, okay. I was like, what is coming on? We have this television monitor in here as well, everyone, where they run programming. I had no clue. It was like World War II footage that just came on. Is this Ross Kemp?
No, this is Truth, Duty, Valor, a program that you can catch all the time on the Fight Network.
I think it's on Wednesday nights at 10.
Oh.
I'm not 100% certain.
Oh, this is terrible. We are doing a terrible job of promos.
TheFightNetwork.com, everyone, for your scheduling needs.
Oh, boy.
I know that Tough Enough is on at 7 and 8 Eastern Monday nights.
I know that,
for brand
too.
New episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mr. Ting, this week we went way back. This was one of our oldest reviews, I think.
Yeah. Well, have we ever done an older one?
What if we reviewed prior to 1989? Because I don't think we've done any of the first four WrestleManias.
We did the first one.
That's right. We did review WrestleMania 1.
Yeah, that was probably the oldest one.
Yeah, that would be the oldest review. But this one, this would be number 2, I believe. Mm-hmm. And what a show it was, everyone. We are going to get right into things. And back in this time period, everyone, the Great American Bash, this was billed as their big event, but it was really like a spring tour of events. The Great American Bash was designed as a tour, and it did some tremendous, tremendous numbers throughout the spring and into the summer for the company. And here in 1989, this was their big show they were building to, the Great American Bash Glory Days.
Glory Days is being the subtitle, yes. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this was like a tribute to Bruce Springsteen.
I don't know. I'm not a big fan.
Neither am I, but I think that's one of his songs.
How many, what was the pay-per-view model like with the NWA at the time?
You know what? I don't even 100% know if this was on pay-per-view.
I think they said.
Did they say pay-per-view, or was this a closed circuit and a home video release?
This was in 1989, so I imagine there to be
Yeah, you're right. It would have been a pay-per-view.
So, but we had, obviously, Starrcade. Did they have the rest of them, like, what is it, Super Brawl and all that?
No, at this point, they were only running, it would have been Great American Bash, Starrcade, I think they had, like, Wrestle War in there, and Halloween Havoc started in 1989.
So one of the few pay-per-view events put on by the organization.
And this took place from the Baltimore Arena, Baltimore, Maryland, July the 23rd, 1989, Wei. Do you remember what you were doing that day?
You know what? This was probably a month away from me and my family immigrating to Canada.
Oh wow!
From Hong Kong
because of this event.
No. Yeah, we can't. We
you just got your countries wrong.
What? Oh, I gotcha.
And we open up this show way with it's like these scenics of Baltimore, and they show these horses. And just various scenery in Baltimore. And this did not start off like a pro wrestling event where two men are going to bleed in the main event. Mm-mm. It started off like NBC would kick off their weekend of the Masters or something like that. Yeah. Like this was done like a legitimate sports opening for a high-class event.
Yeah, incredibly different from what we see today. It's like what you would see, like for a boxing show today, even just like a scenic a shot of the building, shots of the city. Nothing about any of the storylines or personalities involved. It's just a generic scene setter. Here's the sporting event.
Welcome to Baltimore, Maryland, and the high intensity action of Glory Days. In contrast to the serenity of the thoroughbred farms of Worthington Valley, here in Baltimore, the Inner Harbor, one of the great reconstructions of a major city in the United States. Then it's to the action in the Baltimore Arena. Let's go there for World Championship Wrestling.
And it's amazing how the NWA would present their product in this kind of fashion, and they had gigantic fan base. Pro wrestling was extremely more popular at this point in sports or in history, and was also much more respected at this point of time in the late 80s. And yet, things have definitely changed over the last 22 years. And it's just watching this show, it seemed that the NWA was much more entrenched into the Carolinas and here and places like Baltimore, and much more accepted as just a almost, I don't want to say a legitimate sport, but you know, it was much less of like the sideshow circus that I think a lot of people might regard WWE as right now. And that the WWE is constantly trying to have this kind of acceptance. You know what
I
mean? But they despise kind of a lot of what you would see on this show, which they would just classify as old wrestling that we do not want to be a part of. It seems very divided.
Well, even if you contrast the NWA at this time to the WWF at the time, you'll notice quite a bit
products.
Of a difference as well. You know, in the WWF, you had very cartoonish characters with very loud, every promo that anybody cut was just screaming at the top of their lungs, whereas this was presented as a lot more realistic.
I cannot imagine if I was 15 years old watching WWF over NWA. If I had the two options available to me and it was one program to watch.
Some people prefer the characters.
Like especially the mid to late 80s period. I mean, before they got more goofy in the early 90s with RoboCop.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this was say what you will, positive or negative, about WWF and NWA at the time. They were two very distinct products.
Yes.
And I think that contributed to both of their popularity. You got different mm-hmm. things out of both shows.
It's exactly like, I mean, I hate to bring up TNA again, but it's exactly what TNA should be striving for, an actual alternative to what the main mm-hmm. company provides.
They're halfway there. They're just a bad alternative.
They have the same stars, the same world, same champion.
Let's do a count throughout this show of how many of these talents have worked for TNA in the last five
right.
years, okay?
Sure.
Our announcers are Jim Ross and Bob Caudle, who, for my money, one of the most underrated broadcast duos.
I've never heard Bob Caudle before.
Heard of him or heard his
heard
commentary?
I never heard of him, never heard his commentary.
No, he was he was their voice for like their Saturday night program on TBS for a long period. Okay. A real staple of like Mid-Atlantic and then NWA. But I always these two kind of had both like kind of play-by-play backgrounds, and they were working together, but I thought it worked. I thought mm-hmm. Jim Ross was just far and away one of best things on this show.
I found this to be like the perfect... This style of... television.
And these were like two sports announcers
yeah.
calling a product.
This style of like realistic play-by-play is perfect for Jim Ross, and I just found like this show to be Jim Ross at his best.
He was great on this show. We started the show off. They say that we've got a 9-match card ahead for you, everyone, tonight. And the first thing we have are the finals of the 2-ring King of the Hill Battle Royal. Now, this was confusing, and I believe I sent you a message, Way, saying, beware, the opening match of Great American Bash is Vince Russo-level confusing.
Yeah, I got your message. I didn't find it to be too, too confusing, though. I mean, listen,
by the end of it, I understood, but this was insanely overbooked.
Well, okay, let's talk about it. Basically, the concept of the match is you have a battle royal starting in one of the rings, and anytime there was an elimination, anybody who was eliminated from that first battle royal would move on to the second ring.
Yeah, we should explain there were two rings set up.
Oh, yeah.
Here. So
yeah.
This was
for War Games.
Very much like Fall Brawl was yeah. presented later, where you'd have the two rings side by side.
Yes. So anybody eliminated from the first battle royal would move on to the second ring, where they would start a new battle royal.
Where it was like your second chance.
Yeah, your second chance. So the winner, the remaining, the last person to win the first battle royal will stay behind, and the winner of the second battle royal will stay behind, and then the two of them will have a match, and this is all for a $50,000 prize.
And everyone who qualified for this battle royal had won a previous battle royal.
What?
Leading up to this. Didn't you catch this during the commentary?
Wait, hold on a second. You're telling me what, the 30 people in this match all won a battle royal individually?
It was 14 guys.
Telling me the 14 people in this match all won a battle royal at separate times? You're telling me there were 14 battle royals in the build-up to this match?
Not exactly, because Jim Ross said that the entrants of this match qualified by winning a battle royal. Some won more than one. So there were more than 14 battle royals. Some guys won 2 or 3 battle royals to get into this.
Okay, well, I don't know.
I was lost after that statement. I'm like, what the fuck am I watching here?
I don't know about that. Maybe.
I'm sorry. This was at the level of the reverse battle royal in terms of stupidity.
Well, I'm just mainly speaking about this match in itself. I didn't find it to be too confusing. I don't know about winning 14 battle royals. That could have been a slip of the tongue. I'd like to know if that was true. But I didn't find the concept of this match to be any more complex than like an elimination chamber or even the War Games.
I picture the fan that is an on-again, off-again wrestling fan that bought a ticket here, and this was the first match, and they were watching it without the benefit of commentary. I would have been so lost.
But if you were watching the build-up to the show, you would probably know the match type.
Well, if you all won a battle royal, couldn't you just say, we're going to take all these battle royal winners, and they're going to have a super battle royal? Very easy.
Sure. Okay, I don't know. It seems silly to me.
We'll find out.
They would have like 14 battle
Let's get
royals.
Into this. The contestants in the 2-ring King of the Hill Battle Royal, Kevin Sullivan, Mike Rotundo, Flying Brian, did not go by the name Pillman at this point, Scott Hall, Dan Spivey, Dr. Death Steve Williams, Scott Steiner, Rick Steiner, Terry Gordy, Ranger Ross, Sid Vicious,
Ron Simmons, Bill Irwin, and Eddie Gilbert. And Ranger Ross and Simmons were the first ones sent into Ring B. And then Simmons is the first actual elimination when he is eliminated from Ring B. Mm-hmm. Gordy and Irwin are then sent to Ring B. Then, all of a sudden, I don't know... I'm sure you saw this, because this was not a WWE... Because I started watching this on Classics On Demand, or whatever their feed was for WWE. Yeah. And this was not a WWE edit. And it was just like this: they did a wipe, and we go to later in the match. Where members are suddenly in Ring B.
I read a review, actually, while doing some research. I read a review on the VHS copy of these shows, and they would do edits like this to fit the whole show into a two-hour VHS, so that could have been, or three-hour VHS, so that might have been what you saw. I didn't see the edit, though.
Yeah, I did notice it, where all of a sudden we had, so they just, I don't know, cut like 5 minutes out. I wasn't complaining. And they show Dan Spivey. He just murders Ranger Ross with like these two power bombs, and Dan Spivey, I'm sorry, was the most dangerous performer on this show, and he'd be back later on for more just horrible, horrible technique. Mm-hmm. I felt so bad for this guy who was like getting dropped on his head by this just absolutely dangerous worker. And Dan Spivey, I mean...
Dangerous Dan Spivey.
Well, he earned the nickname in this match. Ring A came down to Sid and Pillman, which I found amusing. They had a squeegee match as a result. And
Was that the story between the two of them? Was that who it was?
There was the deal where the two had some argument in a bar, and Pillman wanted to fight Sid. I think it was Sid kind of rubbing it in Pillman's face and some of the mid-carders about how much more money he made, which always endears you to a bar full of wrestlers. And Pillman challenged him to fight. Pillman and Sid, you can obviously see the height differential, and Sid said, "Fine. Let me just go get some." He went outside and he came back with a squeegee to fight Brian Pillman. And that was the famous story with Sid and Pillman.
That's awesome.
This fight was much less competitive, with Sid eliminating Pillman. And this was when Eddie Gilbert and Gordy knocked each other out of Ring B. Before the elimination of Pillman, he delivered these drop kicks to Sid, and then he missed a splash into the ropes. And that's when Sid eliminated Pillman. So we had... Spivey and Mike Rotundo with Brian Pillman in Ring B, and Spivey and Rotundo immediately throw Pillman out of Ring B, so this guy just got...
No, Pillman was already eliminated. Oh, wait, you're right.
And then he went to Ring B, and that's where he got eliminated again, like within a minute. He got eliminated twice, and then Steve Williams was also in Ring B here with Spivey and Rotundo. There was an awkward spot where Rotundo misses a clothesline to Williams into the ropes, and then he flies over the top rope. Then Rotundo trips Dr. Death from outside, and Williams just stops in his tracks, turns his back to Dan Spivey, and is basically asking Rotundo, "Why did you trip me forever?" as Spivey then dumps Williams over the top rope. So we're down to Dan Spivey and Sid Vicious, who comprised the tag team of the Skyscrapers at this time. So we were going to see the two tag partners collide here. Teddy Long, their manager, gets into the ring, and he says he won't allow his team to face each other. And he starts preaching about unity and that they're going to split the $25,000. They're going to split the $50,000 with $25 apiece. So I assume this was when it would be overruled. Nope. This is how it ended. We just cut. That's how this ended.
Sure.
What horrible booking.
Yeah, well... Yeah, no, it would have been disappointing if you were expecting the final match.
But. I'm trying to watch this show with the perspective of what it would have been in 1989, where, I mean, if you had a, you know, Mason Ryan, I don't think anyone would give a fuck if this guy got dropped in a battle royal and eliminated. And I think here they wanted to protect these two so much that they didn't want either to lose, especially Sid, who they were very high on. But I was just like... What a shitty ending to a match that had such a ridiculous concept to start with. It's like, if you have to do such a stupid finish, why were they even in this match?
Well, when you say every man for himself, you know, we've got a lot of tag team partners in that ring right now, and it could wind up partner against partner a little later on when two men are left. And I tell you, partner or not, you put $50,000 in front of one of these guys, and boy, you got a fight on your hands.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's pretty disappointing.
Did it make these two look so dominant that they won the Battle Royal together?
Sure. Yeah, it did.
All right. I would say so.
I think they, you know, at the very least, they're just looking to put heat on Teddy Long and the two of these guys for not going through with the stipulations. But as the Battle Royal itself, I thought I always enjoy Battle Royals to start off a show. I think it makes for a stunning visual, especially in this one with the two rings there. And the crowd was hot for almost all of it.
The crowd was hot for everything on this show. Mm-hmm. Then we go to a plug for an upcoming VHS release. The Danger Zone.
Warning, you are coming face to face with danger.
I rip your neck off and death down your tassel.
The Danger Zone, professional wrestling's most powerful and devastating hour. 60 minutes of wrestling history, now on one hot new video cassette. The Danger Zone, an up-close look at America's most famous and fearsome professional wrestlers, hosted by Magnum T.A. and Missy Hyatt. Plus, if you order now, we'll include a limited edition 1988 swimsuit calendar starring the men of the Danger Zone and the beautiful Missy Hyatt. Hit after hit, hold after hold. Hang on for 1 hour of high-flying action in the Danger Zone. Available on VHS or Beta Video Cassette, only $24.95. And you get the exclusive 88 swimsuit calendar free, but only if you order the Danger Zone now.
A 60-minute video cassette hosted by Magnum T.A. and Missy Hyatt. And this video, eh? Includes a swimsuit calendar with the men of the Danger Zone and Missy Hyatt. A 60-minute VHS with a male swimsuit calendar. Boy, do we know our audience. This was awesome.
Yeah, that's weird. I know, that's weird.
Would a kid really... Oh,
God, Mom, get me the Magnum T.
Johnny Ace and Shane Douglas are going to be in Speedos.
But I'm very glad whoever edits in the WWE kept these into the
they didn't touch this video outside of the main event.
No, they did. They put their little things here and there. They blurred out the WWF.
They had to do that, though. They do that in their own videos. So that wasn't because of what the sign said, which we'll get to.
But normally, you know, like they would probably take out ads like this. But
no, I was glad they
this
left
was
it
just
in
left here for a comedic effect.
Did you notice at the beginning they had like the Turner Home Entertainment screen at the beginning? Yeah. Like it sounds like they put the VHS in and just dubbed it right in. Like there was no
probably all they had
chopping off anything of this. So.
Yeah,
that was funny. Then we go to Gordon Solie, who is the official interviewer for the Great American Bash on behalf of the World Wrestling News Network. And he's with Theodore Long. And Solie was just so serious.
Yep.
And he just talks to Teddy about, that was a very cool move on your part. And then Teddy Long holds up an envelope with the $50,000 that they won, and he has this flimsy cardboard crown that says, we won the triple crown tonight. Yeah. This could not be more of a ghetto-looking crown. let's just hold the envelope up with the money instead of this ridiculous crown. This looked right out of something you would get at the dollar store.
Yeah. Yeah. I had no idea Teddy had missing front teeth.
Oh, I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, he just missed a giant gap in his mouth.
Next up, we've got Flying Brian against Wild Bill Irwin, who we had just seen in the last match. Match starts off with Brian hitting a head scissors. It sends Irwin to the floor. Pillman was then working over the left arm of Irwin, who would later become the Goon in the WWF. Of course, worked world class as well. Irwin was... you know, I wasn't exactly blown away by this guy in the ring, but I did enjoy his like bullying taunts where he'd constantly be yelling at Brian, come on, Brian, fly, fly. Mm-hmm. Just being a total like heel bully here. Irwin then gets the heat for what felt like an eternity here, to the point that the announcers just start talking about the city of Baltimore and other matches on the card they're looking forward to. I mean, there was a big... dead period of time here.
Mm-hmm. Well, JR kind of saves it by pointing out how it's Irwin's plan to slow the pace down to his level to stop this young flying Brian.
Success. Irwin goes into the ropes as Pillman moves out, and then Pillman makes a comeback with a flying clothesline and then a splash in mid-ring for a two-count. Pillman then misses a drop kick coming off the top rope, and finish comes as Irwin slams him into the second ring. Irwin is distracted by the referee as Pillman climbs to the top turnbuckle of the second ring and does a high cross into the first ring and lands on Irwin and gets the win. So you got a high spot finish here from Pillman, who is an extremely athletic young baby face here that they were pushing, and not a great match, but no. It was
your fun.
Second match of a 9-match card.
Yeah.
Gordon Soley is with Paulie Dangerously to discuss his match with Jim Cornette coming up, and Dangerously says he is not concerned with winning this match.
A tuxedo match, by the way.
A tuxedo match.
I laughed at you when you brought up the possibility that Miz and Riley was to become a tuxedo match.
Used to be a huge staple. Guys would have these, and then no, we only want to see women strip in the ring. So not too many tuxedo matches in this day and age. Mm-hmm. He's promoting the match, says he wants to take Cornette out, and he brings up his blown knee that he suffered at Starrcade 86. Just imagine that. Imagine bringing up an injury angle, or not an angle. Cornette legitimately fucked up his leg on that Starrcade scaffold match.
Yep.
And, I mean, something from 2.5 years before. Yep. You know what I mean? And that was a theme throughout here. Ross was always bringing up stuff from years past, like the Road Warriors' first War Games match in 87, and bringing up different events. I'm a big fan of that because it makes these events seem important, where you're like, I'm glad I watched that show when it first came about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah,
it's like today it's a pay-per-view finishes and it's never referenced again. There's no consequences, and it's like, if I skip this pay-per-view, what's the big deal?
Sure, absolutely. And in this scenario, it made for just the perfect way to introduce a gimmick into their upcoming match with the Cornette's injury.
Yeah. Then we this was, I think, every WWE talent that has been future endeavored will get a kick out of this next entrance as Johnny Ace and Shane Douglas come out as the Dynamic Dudes, and Douglas gets to ringside, pulls this big fat kid over the barrier, and they start playing frisbee with the fat kid, and then they take a picture with him.
This was so awesome.
This was 1980s awesome.
The man who holds the fate of every aspiring wrestler in North America
was a dynamic dude.
He's throwing frisbees into the crowd.
And they get into the ring, and a young Jason Hervey climbs up to the ring and gives them high fives before the match starts.
He was just sitting in the front row. He was actually, he was just watching the show the whole match.
I know he was involved with Missy Hyatt at one point. It was just a big
wrestler. What? At that age?
I don't know about that age. It might have been a few years later, but he was a big, big wrestling mark.
Yeah.
And now he's the TMZ guy for TNA. So there, that's number one.
What do you mean? Oh, okay.
It's Jason Hervey, who's the fucking anonymous interviewer.
Shane Douglas?
Shane Douglas has worked there in the last five. Did we pass over anyone else here? Let's quickly look at the Battle Royal here.
Cornette
would be three. Scott Hall would be four. Scott Steiner works there now. So we got five so far.
Okay.
So it's the Dynamic Dudes against the Skyscrapers, Sid Vicious and Dan Spivey, accompanied by Theodore Long. And the Skyscrapers are actually billed from Metropolis, which is a beautiful part of the country, I hear.
Especially
in June. I think they have like a Superman festival every June there.
Yes. Isn't Jason Agnew going
there? Agnew is covering that this
year. Oh, he is. Wow. So, he should have an awesome time.
How lame is that? From Metropolis, the Skyscrapers. So lame. And Jim Ross does a interesting tool here. He's putting over the athleticism of Sid and Dan Spivey, and they're not like guys in other federations. These are real athletes. Yes, they're big, but they're not bodybuilders. They're strength athletes, and like just trying to polish these guys as these supreme athletes.
He's doing his best.
God, if Sid was anything close to an athlete, my God. there was a spot where Teddy Long is showing off the fucking crown once again, this stupid looking crown. And then the cameraman steps up to shoot Long's bald head, and then Teddy Long is getting upset at his head being shot.
Mm-hmm. He had quite the skull in here, Teddy Long.
He did. And Jim Ross then breaks down the power and speed strategies of each team.
This was great. It felt just like an MMA broadcast.
It really was. I just found it amusing here. Jim Ross calling John Laurinaitis' match here. You had the two VPs of talent relations at one point or another. There was this awesome sequence where we got this absolutely shitty tilt-a-whirl head scissors delivered by Shane that was botched to Dan Spivey. Just looked horrible. And then there's a cross body by Johnny Ace off the top that he delivers to Spivey with Shane on all fours. This could not look worse. I mean, Dan Spivey was one uncoordinated dude, man. He was just the shits.
As bad as he was, though, he was the workhorse in this team because once Sid... Oh, my God. Sid tags in.
If you think his work was bad in, the mid-90s, this was... Picture him in, slow motion that being his fast mode in 95. He was so slow.
He was slow and so immobile. He had the athleticism of, a Hulk Hogan right now, back in the 80s.
Sid was just... And I could not believe the reaction here. They went nuts, the audience, when Sid got tagged in. It was they loved this guy.
Well, he just, Despite what he can do in the ring, he just has an incredible physical appearance about the guy.
And Spivey's then back in, hits a side slam to Shane Douglas, and there's these giant chants of "We want Sid."
Mm-hmm.
Spivey then hits a razor's edge to Douglas, and then a big boot that sends Douglas to the floor. Sid gets tagged in. He hits a clothesline, and as the crowd's chanting for him, Sid, the heel, gets on one knee and embraces the cheers here. I guarantee he was doing this on his own because he had a rep for doing this kind of thing at times.
Sure.
And anyway, I just noted here his offense beyond basic, for 1989 standards for a big guy.
He does the rest spot comes where he's applying some hold to Johnny Ace, and the hold here is just Ace is on his belly and Sid is on top of him, placing his hands on the back of Johnny Ace. He's just putting his hands there, not I guess he's showing that he's applying pressure, but what type of a move is this? I've never seen a move like this where you're just holding the guy's back.
He's got so much power. They build to a hot tag to Johnny Ace, who hits a top rope clothesline onto Spivey. Sid breaks it up, and then all four are fighting in the ring. The skyscrapers go to run into Ace in the middle of the ring. He ducks, and Spivey and Sid collide with each other. Then Ace hits a running head scissors, gets stopped by Sid in midair, and takes a spine buster by Spivey. And then Johnny Ace took the worst powerbomb in history from Dan Spivey. At this point, I was just so sick of Dan Spivey on this show. I was just lost here. And this was the finish. Dan Spivey, who has never been used by the WWE since Laurinaitis got into power. And I'm not surprised. And the skyscrapers get the win here.
Yes.
This was quite the match to watch for many reasons. Not much.
It was interesting.
But Dan Spivey, everybody.
Well, listen, he worked hard. He tried. That's more than I can say for Sid. Sid was just...
I want to create the Bryan Adams Award and give it to Dan Spivey for this show. Gordon Solie is with Jim Cornette.
Well, let me tell you, Paulie Dangerously, he's done his homework. He was exactly right on all his facts. At Starrcade 86, I did get knocked off that scaffold, and I did blow my knee completely out. I suffered a torn anterior cruciate ligament. I underwent surgery. I was in a hospital for a while, and I still have to wear a brace because orthoscopic surgery couldn't repair it sufficiently. So you've done your homework right, Paulie. But I tell you this, this is a chance for me to prove myself. This is a chance for me to get some satisfaction, not only for myself, but for all those people across the country who would like to take one of these and put it upside your head. And that's why I don't care. If you break one of my legs, I'll come hopping to you. If you break both of my legs, I'll crawl like a reptile on my belly to get to you, Polly. Because I want some satisfaction. You've tried everything that you could think of to take my place in the NWA. You've copied my men. You've copied their moves. You've copied my dirty tricks and my cheap tactics. You have tried to take my place. But the only way you'll ever take my place, Polly, is when I'm 6 feet under. And if you want me there, you're going to have to put me there yourself. You ain't man enough to do it. And I'm going to prove something right here. Because if there's one time in his life that Jim Cornette needed to get physical and needed to win a fight, then, brother, it's right now. And I'm going to get it everything I got. And part of it's going to be for me. But part of it's going to be for all those people who have supported me. And after all the things that I've done in the past, has said, Jim Cornette, we're on your side. I'm getting out of here.
Well, all right. We're going to the ring, and let's hope it's not the end of the career for Jim Cornette. Let's go to the ring.
Soli just had these awesome like lines at the end of the promos, where these guys would cut these huge promos, and then the stoic Gordon Soli just summed up the entire promo.
He is fantastic. And Cornette and Heyman were both excellent, as well as you would expect. I wish I could have seen the entire program between just these two. And if there's ever a DVD collection of just the promos between these two, I would totally be the first.
So that brings us to our next match, which on paper was not looking too promising. Pauly Dangerously against Jim Cornette in a manager's tuxedo match. Mm-hmm.
There's a sign in the crowd that reads, NWA is number one, and the WWF stinks. And, of course, the WWF is blurred out.
Which they have to do for all WWF. I'm sure, company, who would care about this? Heyman hits Cornette with powder in the face to start the match, and then attacks Cornette's knee with his cell phone. And Jim Ross is like making these like off-color remarks about Heyman, saying that, noting Paulie's offense, he says, Paulie with a somewhat feminine hand, and then he made some reference to his friends in San Francisco.
You're saying he was probably coached by a Bruce or Eric from San Francisco.
That was the line.
Yeah. I don't think he'd be able to get away with that today.
No. Paul E. Homosexual was, I guess, what Jim Ross was alleging here.
Okay.
It's all Dangerously choking Cornette with his cummerbund from his suit until Cornette makes a brief comeback with a choke spot. Crowd was behind Cornette here. Cornette is then run shoulder first into the post. Cornette makes a comeback with punches. This was not pretty, folks. I do not want to mask this. But, a crowd that's into something makes up for a lot.
I wouldn't say it looked that bad either. I mean, their selling was pretty good, and the punches didn't look that bad. And I can honestly say with 100% truthfulness, they are already way better than Sid, these two.
You might be right here. I thought this match went a bit too long. Eventually, the shirt is taken off Dangerously, and then Cornette gets the pants off after Cornette kicks powder into the face of Dangerously when Dangerously went for the powder again. Dangerously is in his purple underwear and runs to the back as fans cheer loudly for Cornette winning. And at the end of it, Cornette throws down Dangerously's phone and tennis racket and proclaims himself the better man.
I enjoyed this match. I thought it was well booked, and it wasn't that long. It was like, a good amount. I thought it was better than matches of this variety that we see today.
This
some
was
of the recent ones, like
a
Cole
lot
and
better
Lawler,
than Cole and Lawler, WrestleMania,
and Vince and Brett.
Gordon Soli is with Gary Hart. Look at the fucking managers they had at this point.
Oh my God!
Cornette, Dangerously, Gary Hart, Paul Ellering. I mean, just a fantastic lineup they have here of guys.
Really points out how beneficial.
And the talkers on this show.
Yeah.
Just fantastic.
That's what I mean. It just really points out how beneficial managers can be to professional wrestling today.
Yeah. So Gary Hart says that Great Muta is getting ready for Sting and is going to prove that Japan has the best athletes today. And Muta is busy meditating right now, as all Asians do before big athletic events.
Yeah, I meditate before these podcasts.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
I never know what you're doing in the corner there at the end of the workspace.
Yep.
We then go to a tag match. It's Kevin Sullivan and Mike Rotundo against the Steiner Brothers, who are accompanied by Missy Hyatt and their dog.
Mm-hmm.
What was this dog?
Isn't this the Rick Steiner's dog?
I guess so.
From Michigan?
They're having a Texas Tornado match in Baltimore. And early on, we see tons of headshots exchanged by Rick Steiner and Kevin Sullivan on the floor. They continue to brawl on the floor while Scott and Rotundo fight in the ring. All four then manage to get into the ring with the Steiners delivering suplexes to the heels. Scott and Rotundo then go to the floor. Sullivan lifts Rick and is basically setting him up for a slam, and Scott comes off the top rope delivering a cross body to Rick, who's being held by Kevin, and basically Rick and Scott both land on Sullivan and pin him. This was like 4 minutes, and the Steiner brothers get the win here.
Yeah.
Just like a 4 minute brawl.
Yeah. This was a, I think this was a Scott Steiner's first pay-per-view appearance, I read somewhere. So, just kind of chaotic. A bit of a chaos. And seemed like a big win for the Steiners.
And then we go to Gordon Soley, who is accompanied by Sting, discussing the Great Muta being undefeated. And Sting is alongside Eddie Gilbert. Thought this was a very bad promo by Sting. He just like...
Why?
Ah, his voice was just up and down. Then he wanders off camera.
The point of this promo was to show that he was nervous, that he can't stay still because he's so excited.
Congratulations.
Well, that's exactly what the point was.
Well, I don't know how that added to this.
It's to show that he could lose. He's okay. Concerned about losing.
And then Eddie Gilbert cut the real promo for this match, and they put over Muta, but said they don't like Gary Hart. So it takes us to the next match, way Sting defending the NWA television title against the Great Muta. And this, I was wondering, would this live up to the match we saw on Impact?
I don't know. Muta came out to a gong and everything. They actually had a gong.
Well, that's what I'd want to hear after I meditate.
Where's the rickshaw? Should have come out in a rickshaw with
a rice hat and some powder, salt.
Uh-huh.
And,
what else? Calculator.
The wooden sandals.
Abacus.
Abacus.
The Pearl of the Orient.
Is that what he was called?
Yeah.
Anyway, the match starts off with...
I totally understand some of these things taking place at that time, but I think this stuff's still going on now. Like these types of... stereotypes in wrestling.
Well, that's what
the Muta gimmick is a stereotype. The Muta gimmick is awesome, but I just mean some of these things that dress up these entrances.
The match starts with Sting diving into the second ring to hit Muta, and Ross calls this the Battle of the Paint. Not the most marketable slogan. Muta then hits a springboard back elbow to Sting in the corner. Muta then comes back with a moonsault, but Sting gets out of the way. Muta lands on his feet, and Sting then no-sells a spin kick, and Muta hits him again with one, knocks him to the floor, and then a pescado by Muta. Muta's speed here was just incredible. I mean, quite the contrast to if you've seen him compete, you know, right now, where obviously his knees are shot. The guy's like 48 years old.
Mm-hmm. And
resigned. Watching him here was incredible.
Just resigned as president of All Japan.
Yes, he had to step down. Very a big scandal going on right now with All Japan. Then we see a reverse chin lock spot by Muta, and Sting fights back into an abdominal stretch he applies. And then basically they slow the pace down here with moments of fire from Sting for brief comebacks here as Muta continues to work over. Crowd was really into the match here. Muta briefly powders to the floor with Gary Hart, but then comes back in. Muta goes for the mist, but Sting ducks, so it takes out Nick Patrick. And then at this point, with the referee out, Sting misses a splash into the corner, and Muta hits a moonsault onto Sting, and then Tommy Young dives into the ring, makes a two count, and Sting kicks out. Huge pop for the kick out by the audience. Then we see a belly-to-back suplex delivered by Sting, and a three count is made, and they try to play up the controversial finish, and if Sting's shoulders were down along with Muta's. And what happens here is Gary Hart gives the title to Muta, feeling that his client had won. And there's chance of bullshit from the audience. And then the replay shows that Sting's shoulder was up, but at the three count, Muta lifts his right shoulder. So they basically end this in controversy, and obviously the feud is going to continue. But overall, crowd was very much into this match, as I thought they were for just about everything on this show. Yep. And Muta worked tremendously in here with Sting, who was still very, very green at this point.
The match was good. I thought it was just a bit too short, you know, especially if this was one of the only four pay-per-views. But it built perfectly for continuing this program.
Gordon Soley is with U.S. champion Lex Luger. And Luger says, "I say what I mean." And says he has a surprise for Ricky Steamboat. calls himself the greatest United States champion in history, and then jumbles all his words up, trying to say, there will be no DQ match. And I said it way better than he did, and says it's going to be a straight match. And Luger walks off, and Sully just ends it with, Lex Luger, is he demonstrating arrogance or prudence? I love Gordon Sully on this show.
Well, his style is like, he's like a newscaster.
Arrogance or prudence?
Mm-hmm.
We get Ricky Steamboat making his entrance. Gary Michael Capetta, the announcer, introduces him and says, coming to the ring, accompanied by his beautiful family, Ricky Steamboat, who is his wife and child walk out there while dad gets lifted out on this giant...
like a surfboard.
Yeah.
Like a board.
And there's these, like, slaves carrying him while Ricky is standing on top of it with a giant lizard wearing a studded leather jacket. What the fuck was this?
This is pro wrestling.
First of all, that's a very heel entrance.
No, it's not.
Having these fuckers carry you to the ring?
It's just a guy.
While your wife and child walk?
It's not like he was sitting. He was standing on the board.
That's even worse. I'm putting more weight on you.
You're not putting more weight. It's the same weight.
Why did this guy have a lizard?
He's the dragon.
That's a dragon.
It's a Komodo dragon.
Oh, my God.
I don't know why the Komodo dragon was wearing a leather vest with metal spikes.
It had, like, fucking metal spikes coming out of the back of the leather jacket.
That I didn't understand.
That the dragon was wearing.
Well,
fuck.
Supposed to make a grand entrance.
Then the announcer, they show a sign that says Year of the Dragon. And the announcers say, well, it is the Year of the Dragon. It was the Year of the Snake in 1989.
Well, yeah, that's so funny. Thanks for checking up.
I did. I did my research here.
Very good.
I was very perplexed by this entrance here by Ricky Steamboat.
Well, they wanted to show that he was a big deal. And to contrast that, we had Lex Luger's entrance.
He had the most 80s wrestling theme on this show, I think.
I checked afterwards, and this wasn't his usual theme. I think the WWE piped this in after.
Yeah.
I quite liked the whatever he had here. It was like a very retro 80s, electronic type of thing. But Luger, for his entrance, they announced Luger, and then they cut to a shot of him. Luger is standing on a turnstile that has a motor in it, so it's swiveling by itself. But by the time
I miss this?
Luger is posing on this turnstile, and by the time that the turnstile turns through, like a turning platter, by the time that Luger turns and eventually gets his face facing the entrance, it stops. Like, the motor stops working. And so, like, Luger tries to, like, pivot himself using his hips to make the thing go.
I missed all
and
of
then,
this.
But it doesn't, so it's just the funniest thing.
By the way, Sting was number 6. Lex Luger was number 7 here.
Luger was
TNA
in TNA?
Luger's
in the past 5 years?
He appeared in that cameo, remember? I know he did some matches. He did one where he lost to AJ Styles, which might have been before they were on Spike, but I know he's appeared on TNA just in a non-wrestling role.
Well, if we do a TNA count, we should do a WWE count as well, because we have Ricky Steamboat here.
Okay, well, let's start at the beginning then and quickly...
Whatever.
No. We'll do it. I want to find this out here, okay? Okay, we'll do it at the end of the show,
we'll do it at the end.
So, anyway... Luger gets on the mic and he tells Steamboat, you have to waive the no disqualification stipulation or I won't wrestle. Which, there was an obvious punchline there. And Steamboat agrees to waive the stipulation. So, the heel here had a lot of power.
Sure. I don't know why people don't do that.
This was promoted as a no DQ match. And you bought this pay-per-view and you do not get a no DQ match.
Mm-hmm.
What is the upside in this way?
The upside is that you'll get the pay next month for the next show.
Because I'm guessing someone wouldn't job here and they had to end it in a DQ. That would have been my assumption.
Okay. Well, they seem to put it... Jim Ross seemed to convey that they were building to the no DQ match for next time.
Yeah. This is one of those shows I really wish I had like a June 1989 Observer to see what was going on.
Right.
So... We have Lex Luger, Ricky Steamboat, U.S. title in a no-DQ match. No-DQs allowed match.
A no-DQ match.
A no-DQ match.
As Luger puts it.
Steamboat starts off with chops. They fight on the floor. An atomic drop is delivered to Luger. Luger then got the heat for the next few minutes, and Luger talks to the ref, and he's getting upset, and then he gets rolled up. It was a hope spot for Steamboat fans. Pop here for the near fall. Luger kicks out. And then we go back to Luger, who hits consecutive body slams and drops Steamboat's neck onto the top rope. Steamboat pounds on the chest of Luger on the apron, then hits a vertical suplex, and Luger lands on top for a two count as they come into the ring. We see Steamboat go to the top with a chop off the top rope for a two count, and then Steamboat takes a back body drop into the next ring, and Luger then grabs a chair. Steamboat stops him and slingshots Luger into the turnbuckle as Luger does not let go of this chair and ends up knocking himself in the head. And then Steamboat grabs the chair, the referee goes to stop him, and Steamboat tosses the ref down and hits Luger with the chair for the disqualification, and then hits Luger with a back shot, then into the ribs, and Luger runs away on the floor, and Steamboat has to go at like negative miles an hour here. As he goes to wind up, Luger's out of the way, Steamboat finishes his rotation to hit the barricade like three different times in different sections. And then Steamboat finally gets to the entrance. Luger's backstage, and Steamboat poses with the chair.
They were much safer with these chair shots.
Oh, and the reactions were 10 times bigger than you would hear with, like, chair shots. Like, the chair shot was very rare at this point. So just the fact he connected with Luger's back, the fans went nuts here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I thought Steamboat did a very good good job in this match, and I thought Luger looked okay, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, at this point in time, Sid and Luger were, like, these pegged to be the future of the industry, which I don't think either really came anywhere close to. But in 1989, I mean, both were very hot prospects here in the NWA, and I thought Luger looked okay. I mean, if I had just watched this match, I would have been a believer in Lex Luger as being a future guy.
Absolutely.
I don't know about Sid.
Absolutely. But I thought this was a good match, and the crowd was very into it as well.
So, I guess another feud that is going to continue.
Mm-hmm.
Then the cage is lowered for the upcoming War Games match, and we get promos from both teams. It's going to be 5-on-5, and we start with Michael Hayes, who's accompanied with the Freebirds, Jimmy Garvin and Terry Gordy, along with the Samoan SWAT team, Fatu and Samu. The Freebirds are wearing the official shades of the 1980s, those, like, giant glasses that cover not just your eye, but your entire, like, orbital area.
Those are making a comeback.
Are they?
I think so.
Maybe it's the Ricky Bobby influence.
No,
I'm thinking of Eastbound and Down.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
Anyway,
yeah, we're going to get shit from the fans.
Danny McBride's character.
Yeah. Oh, fuck, what is in them?
You better look it up so because we're going to get... You guys don't watch Zack Ryder know the character's name.
Oh, man.
Ricky Bobby. I'm going to get Will Ferrell on Danny McBride's body.
What the fuck is his name? We'll completely edit this so that...
No,
we don't look so ridiculous. Give me 1 second here. Kenny Powers. Fuck. I got a guy right here on the Facebook group who's explaining. Stanley Ipkiss is explaining. Not sure if...
That's in the feedback.
Oh, okay. All right, we'll get to it.
We'll get to Stanley Ipkiss.
Oh, man.
Great, great name. All right, Michael Hayes does the majority of this promo. The Samoans are booked to just yell incoherently as Hayes and Garvin kind of carry the promo here. Mm-hmm, and then Gordy ends saying that a bomb is going to drop in Baltimore and explode through your television set.
Yeah, this is great.
Gordy looked like he had just had nothing but coffee and maybe some other substances before this promo because he looked out of his mind.
Well, that's his character.
You know,
live your part.
I know some people look at these promos from the 80s as just like, oh, they're so funny to watch back. I love these kinds of promos.
I do too.
I was interested in this match by the end of this promo.
Yeah.
And Ross explains that the Freebirds and Samoans won the coin toss backstage. So amazing how it works out that the heels will have the extra man advantage.
Amazing. Has there ever been a War Games where the baby faces had the advantage?
TNA's done it with Lethal Lockdown.
Oh, man. Wow.
Then we get a promo from the Babyfaces, who are the Midnight Express, Stan Lane and Bobby Eaton, Dr. Death, Steve Williams, and the Road Warriors. And this promo starts off with Lane and Eaton talking, and Steve Williams flies across the screen, like right out of the Hurricane or Dude Love's Titantron video.
Yeah.
I lost my shit watching this. I laughed so hard here. And then Steve Williams grabs the mic and says, "I'm bird hunting for free birds." Mm-hmm. God bless Dr. Death, Steve Williams. And he says he's looking for bug spray to kill the Samoans.
He didn't say Samoans. He says Samoleons.
And you know something? I'm looking out here for my bug spray to kill the Samoans.
They're like Mongolians.
Yeah.
Or Samoleons.
Or Somalians.
Somalians. Then the Road Warriors walk in, and it was kind of interesting here. They had the Road Warriors. They were never in the same shot as the Midnight Express.
Hmm.
And they only had Dr. Death interact with the Road Warriors. And Hawk says they are going for family members. And this was your typical Road Warriors promo, animal setup Hawk. And
Hawk says,
angry promo.
When we're done with you, we're going for your family members.
That's what he said, yes.
Yeah. So he's gonna
jot it down. Point.
He's gonna kill Michael Hayes' wife and daughter as well.
The baby face as well. So that brings us to War Games, everyone. And it starts off the heels have Paulie Dangerously in the corner, while the baby faces have Jim Cornette and Paul Ellering. And the Road Warriors come out on motorcycles, driven by some random guy.
Yep.
And my God, was Baltimore just going ape shit here for the Road Warriors?
No,
I cannot think of too many reactions stronger than the Road Warriors got on this show. Mm-hmm. I mean, this crowd was nuts for these two.
Oh, Sid Vicious. They loved Sid.
They were into Sid, but not to the degree. Like, it must have been shaking in the Baltimore arena when they got into the match.
Hmm.
It was huge. The Samoans punch each other in the chest for motivation. I mean, the stereotypes on this show were just amazing. I'm surprised they weren't eating like raw fish on the way to the ring. Jimmy Garvin and Bobby Eaton start the match, and this is basically, for you TNA fans, the same setup as Lethal Lockdown, where the first two would start for 5 minutes, and then a new member would enter every 2 minutes, and then when all 10 were in, that's when the match could end. So no falls counted until all 10 were in. And that was something I was never a big fan of with War Games, where it's like, what am I watching here? I'm just watching guys go back and forth, and I know nothing. Don't get too invested in anything, mm-hmm. because the match doesn't really start till everyone's in there, and you have a giant wait period here.
Yeah.
So, anyway, Jim Ross notes the huge technological advancements of this year's War Games because we have a cameraman inside the cage for the match.
Wow.
Look out, Vince.
Look out, Apple.
Eaton tries to use the cage ceiling, but is not able to hit Garvin when he climbs and tries to kick Garvin. Dangerously, he's on the phone here, trying to, I guess, talk about strategy and plan on the outside. Very slow pace for the start. Terry Gordy was the third person in, so the heels had the two-on-one advantage, and Gordy and Garvin would double-team Eaton. Gary Michael Capetta for the next entrance. It was Dr. Death, and as he's counting down from 10, his voice starts to crack. Williams gets into the ring. He continually presses Gordy into the top of the cage.
Like eight times.
Eight times.
Like a military press.
I know.
Eight times.
This looked
fantastic.
These two would have some phenomenal singles matches years later in All Japan during the early 90s. Samu is then next into the match, so the heels are back up 3-2. Then Road Warrior Animal evens up the numbers. A monstrous pop here as he enters, and he just kills all of the heels. And Ross notes, business is about to pick up for a few minutes. Then we're on the floor, and Hayes is giving instructions to Fatu. He says, kill, kill, eat, eat.
Hayes was fantastic, I thought, just playing
his
part.
Interplay with the crowd, and it was really good here. He was just yelling at the fans at ringside. At one point, he was yelling at one of the babyfaces selling on the floor, and he almost dropped an F-bomb, but held himself and just, like, caught his tongue. Fatu then comes in. The Samoans double-team Animal as the crowd is chanting for Hawk, but it's Stan Lane who is next in, so it's down to 4-on-4. It's funny here. We saw Paulie Dangerously making notes, and we also saw Paul Ellering jotting down notes with Jim Cornette. These were active managers back in 89. Hayes is talking to Dangerously and says he doesn't want to go into the match, but he is the fifth member of the heels. And then Hayes comes in. It's 5-on-4. He delivers DDTs to Dr. Death, Bobby Eaton, and Road Warrior Animal, and then gets into the second ring all by himself and just starts strutting. And Hawk is the last babyface in, attacks everyone. He goes for Garvin, hits a clothesline off the top to Garvin, then hits him with a reverse neckbreaker, and then lifts him into a hangman maneuver. And this is where Garvin submits. So once Hawk got in, it was pretty much went right to the finish, where Hawk worked over the neck very briefly and Garvin submitted, and the babyfaces get the win. After the match, the babyfaces are exiting, and as Hawk leaves and Animal's about to leave, and the heels all close the door and they beat on Animal as the babyfaces all are trying to get back into the ring to help him. Hawk eventually rips the door open, the heels all flee the ring, and we get the baby faces triumphing here to end the match. So, crowd was really into things. Sounds like a broken record on this show. They were really into the Road Warriors. Not the best War Games match I've ever seen, but you had some really good workers in this match, particularly Dr. Death, Terry Gordy when he was still a top worker, Bobby Eaton. Good stuff in this match.
There's not much of a finish there, but submission seemed like the right way to go. I mean, I just think it's tough to focus your attention on one single two people if it was just a pinfall when you have like 10 guys in there. But I like the War Games format. It allows for natural peaks and valleys with the heels and
it was faces. A big draw for the NWA. I mean, they really protected that gimmick and made it very strong. Gordon Solis with Ric Flair discusses coming back from his neck injury, where Terry Funk pile drove him onto a table, and says that Terry Funk is going to have the fight of his life tonight. And basically, Gordon Solis is questioning why Flair didn't take a pre-match warm-up on television. And Flair said, well, because you don't give away matches for free on television. You build to the pay-per-view.
Yes.
We should update our count because Flair would be 8. The Road Warriors worked for TNA, but not in the last 5 years. So we'll give them a pass. And was there anyone else in this match? We had... I think that's about it.
Okay.
8. Main event, Ric Flair and Terry Funk. First of all, Bob Caudle and Jim Ross break down the main event, and it's going to be all built around the pile driver. And this was a nice setup, and basically they promised to stay on the air until the match concludes and said, if we have to start our replay late, then that's what we'll do.
Yes.
All right. And that's... We go to the entrances. Funk comes out with Gary Hart and a team of security. I always find this to be a really strong visual. When someone comes out with a bunch of security guards, I really noticed that added something. Back at that... Oh, you weren't there. At the Brantford show, where Hogan came out at the end of the night, and he was surrounded by security. And I just thought, it's a strong visual.
Sure.
Worked for Goldberg.
Looked good. I don't know. I have to see it to really comment. I never thought about it too much. I really enjoyed Flair's entrance here, though. Just fireworks, and then the guy lifts his arms, and the girls link up in perfect formation.
Great formation.
Yeah.
So Flair's out with 4 chicks, has some pyro, and they fight on the floor first with Flair attacking Funk. Funk then gets upset. He stalls on the floor, climbs over the barricade. He's all pissed. Then back in the ring, Funk works towards getting a pile driver, but Flair avoids it. And that's what this match is pretty much all built around, attacking Flair's neck. They fight on the floor. Flair starts attacking the neck of Funk, so basically going in reverse here. And then hits Funk with a pile driver, then hits him again with a pile driver. And Funk tries to leave, but he's brought back, and Flair continues to attack. He applies the figure four leg lock, but then Gary Hart tosses in the branding iron, and Funk is able to break the hold. Now, as I said, I was watching the Classics on Demand feed here, and this is when Flair started to juice, and the screen went to black and white.
Yeah.
God, did this piss me off, to the point that I found this match on YouTube to watch the rest of it. It was so annoying.
Yeah, I was surprised.
Who's going to be offended by this on a video on demand service?
I don't know.
Oh, what a waste of resources and going back to do this for all your bloody matches in the 80s and 90s. Holy crap.
I don't know if they have just, laws to abide by with their ratings or whatnot.
Come on. all their stuff is rated TV-14. It's not even rated PG on their video on demand service.
I don't know.
Come on.
I don't understand it.
Anyway. Funk eventually hits him with a pile driver. Then they have a very awkward back and... the awkward part was going back and forth from color shots to black and white. And this is when I moved over to YouTube. And Flair gets his foot on the ropes after a pile driver for a two count. Flair is then choking Flair with his wrist tape as Tommy Young tries to stop Terry Funk by grabbing his hair to pull him off. Funk goes for a pile driver onto the floor, onto the cement, but Flair blocks it and hits Funk with a back body drop. Then they go back into the ring, and Flair gets hit with a reverse neck breaker by Funk, and Funk is constantly yelling at Flair to quit. Flair knocks Funk headfirst into the post when they go back to the floor, as Flair regains the advantage, and now Terry Funk is bleeding. Great brawl between these two. And then Flair then misses a running knee into the corner. This allows Funk to go for the spinning toe hold, and then Flair counters with a figure four attempt, gets cradled by Funk, and then Flair reverses that with a cradle of his own and gets the three count for the win. And afterwards, Flair hits Gary Hart after the match, but before Flair can celebrate, Great Muta runs in, and Funk and Muta double-team Ric Flair. Muta hits Ric Flair with the mist, and then they continue to attack Flair. They hit him with the belt. They go for a pile driver onto the chair, but head of security Doug Dillinger does a run-in way, and he gets knocked down by Muta and Funk. And before they can hit the pile driver, Sting runs in for the save, fights off Muta and Funk, and they really hit it home here with the announcers saying that this feud is not over. Terry Funk is still standing, and clearly this is going to continue. And the closing scene, the heels from the floor throw a chair into the ring at Ric Flair, and Ric Flair just loses his shit here, runs out to the floor, chases after the heels. They chase them backstage, and the baby faces, Flair and Sting, stand at the entrance, and that's how the show ends. And we go into the credits at the end of the show, and just an awesome crowd, I thought, for this show. It was really, really strong. It was a very, very good show, and the crowd, I think, accentuated it that much more. And some people call this one of the best pay-per-views in history. I'm not going to go to that level, but this was a very good show.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the show as well, simply because, you know, for the ability to get to see wrestling in this era, in this, this style, it was really refreshing. The roster at the time was tremendous. Jim Ross, to me, was the MVP of this show. I thought, out of anything I've heard of him, I thought he was at his best in doing this type of wrestling in this type of environment. I think what kept it from being, you know, maybe a classic was just there really weren't, in my opinion, any standout classic matches on the show. They were just all kind of there, either maybe a little bit too short or a little bit too slow. So I give this a 7.5 out of 10.
I give it an 8 out of 10. A rare week where I give something a higher grade than you. But a very, very good show, and I agree. Jim Ross is just fantastic on this show. So from there, everyone, we're going to go into your feedback, and let's start off with Steve Kassan. I have always read from Pro Wrestling Illustrated and The Wrestler, I know I'm dating myself, that Great American Bash 89 was one of the best pay-per-views, eagerly awaiting your review of it. So that goes back to our statement. I thought it was a very, very good show, and it's hard to judge, events at the time. Like, maybe if we were watching this in 1989 live, and we're more into the storylines going into this and the payoff, and, it's very different to watch shows then and now and kind of contrast. But
absolutely. Lee Russell, a fairly historic Great American Bash, and probably the best one. Steiner's debut in a hell of a brawl with the Varsity Club. Sting versus Muta at their peak of their awesomeness. Lex Luger versus Steamboat, with Steamboat managing to make Luger look pretty good. A War Games match. And one of the greatest matches of all time between Ric Flair and Terry Funk. Jim Cornette beats Paulie dangerously in a comedy match. Even the filler matches were inoffensive. What's not to love?
I thought the brawling between Flair and Funk was really strong. I mean, Flair working as a babyface, there was no issue with that at all. And they made it look like a really gritty brawl. I enjoyed that. It was just little things in that match that really clicked. Matthew Tremblay, I have this pay-per-view on my external hard drive. I'll make sure to watch it this week to give my review. Sting versus Muta looks like a match for the ages.
Kevin Waters, watching this is depressing. I thought these matches were so far above what is presented on TV and pay-per-view today. Plus Jim Ross on play-by-play. I really enjoyed Sting versus Muta. They always worked well together. Sting's crossbody from one ring to another was great. Ric Flair and Terry Funk was good. Even Luger was carried to a good match. Flair's promo at the end on Funk with the top part of his face with red with blood and bottom green from Muda's Mist was a good visual. A very good pay-per-view, maybe even the best Great American Bash.
Corey Ferreira. Great American Bash 89 is a decent show. Sting and Great Muda put on a good match. The two of them always had good in-ring chemistry. The War Games match is fun, but doesn't hold up to the original War Games. Flair and Funk is fine, but their I Quit match from Clash of the Champions 9 is better. A decent show overall.
Eddie Miguez. The skyscraper splitting the winner's purse for the King of the Hill Battle Royal must infuriate Vince Russo every time he hears of it. As we all know, tag team partners are supposed to team for 2 weeks and then feud instantly, not make logical decisions such as, let's both win and go get some beers. I love this show. The entrances are all badass, and I doubt something as unique as it can ever be recreated. This also taught me that Sting was awesome. He was as exciting and hardworking as anyone on the show. Loved every match he had with Muda. I'm stuck on the entrance for Flair, Funk, and Muda. Three of the most epic of all time.
Let's go to Nate Milton. Brother Pollock and Brother Ting. This show is one of the best examples as to why I always preferred the NWA product to what the WWF was presenting at the time. The athleticism and realism displayed on this show grabbed you as a viewer and didn't let go. What really made this pay-per-view special was the three singles matches that highlighted the show. The U.S. title match showcased Ricky Steamboat and the total package Lex Luger in their prime. Luger was a great athlete and Steamboat was in the middle of one of his best years. The Mid-Atlantic crowd was behind every chop he threw. This still ranks as one of Luger's best matches. The TV title match was also very good. Obviously, I was and still am a fan of the Sting-Great Muda rivalry, and even though this isn't quite as good as some of their later matches, it was still way ahead of its time in terms of the athleticism displayed by both Sting and Muda. From Sting leaping over the ropes to attack Muda to the Pearl of the Orient breaking out innovative moves that are still used to this day. This matchup was a glimpse into the future of the fast-paced, high-flying style that would begin to gain popularity in the mid-90s. Finally, the main event feud between Ric Flair and Terry Funk was worth it for the promos alone. Flair was Flair, and Terry Funk showed that he still had a lot of fight left in him. It's funny how now to look back and remember that 1989, Terry Funk was considered past his prime. Funk really hit his stride as part of Gary Hart's JTEX Corporation, and his matches with Flair that year were some of the best of his career. All in all, I think the show lives up to its billing as not only the best show of 1989, which was an extremely good year for the NWA, but one of the best North American shows ever. It's a shame that WCW and ultimately the WWE did so much to tarnish the name of the Great American Bash. But at least we can still go back and watch classics like this show. I give it an 8 out of 10.
It's a really good review from Nate.
Yeah, that was excellent.
Matt Bouchard, just a couple of notes after listening to the recent review of Slamboree. Not sure if anyone mentioned this, but our reviewers weren't sure where Scott Hall was during this time. He was taken off TV for a short while in early 1998 in a show of power by WCW president Eric Bischoff as a way to keep Hall and Nash in check, and was forced by the company to enter rehabilitation after he and Nash both showed up to the March 16th, 98 edition of Nitro heavily intoxicated, according to Wikipedia. Also, the WCW mascot seen doing Benoit's entrance is Wildcat Willie. Rumor is that he was played by Lanny Poffo, but who knows for sure?
I'm pretty sure it wasn't Lanny Poffo, because I think I've talked to him about this. I believe it wasn't, but chance I could be
Jesus,
mistaken there.
Wildcat Willie.
Yeah, what a great concept. And clearly, the March 16th, 98 Nitro is one we might have to review one day.
Oh, yeah.
Paul Grinke, just listened to the first few minutes of the Slamboree review, and I'd like to say that you guys work really hard. If you wanted to discreetly put some advertising in the podcast, go for it. Anybody who not only sits through Impact every week, but then rants about it for over an hour in their bathroom at 1 a.m. deserves to make some money.
Stuart Thibodeau. Hi, John and Wade. Just finished listening to WrestleMania 8. You talk about your experience with Bruce Hart, and I thought I'd share my personal experience with Bruce. Here in Calgary, Bruce sometimes works as a substitute teacher, and back in grade 10, he came to teach my phys ed class. He showed up wearing jeans tucked into construction boots and a fanny pack. The whole class, he talked about amateur wrestling, and when he attended our high school, he didn't do any athletic activity. It was a surreal experience.
I think Bruce Hart has taught every person we've ever spoke to in Calgary.
Perhaps.
Remember when we were out there and we just randomly met someone at the radio station who was like, yeah, I've had Bruce teach me.
Yeah.
Aaron Webb. Had the same thing with Keith teaching my grade 8 math class. We did nothing, and he even had a Q&A period if kids had any wrestling questions, answering honestly. Didn't even bother to protect kayfabe back in 1995 with a bunch of 14-year-olds. Had Bruce once subbed for my band class. He showed up with his wrestling cowboy boots on and proceeded to let the kids have free time as he knew nothing about music. A few friends and I stuck around, and he showed us how to properly Ric Flair chop someone's chest. Fun times, courtesy of Fairview Junior High. That would be awesome.
Yeah, it sounds much more interesting than
my band classes sucked. Yeah. I almost got kicked out of band on a
story. Yeah, that's weird.
Someone's going to ask me the story. I'll quickly tell. It was grade 8 band class, and I played the clarinet, and I was playing, and I guess someone had made a screw-up, and everyone had stopped, and I had kept playing. And this girl behind me was like, John, stop playing. And it was one of those moments where you just get really, really mad, but I didn't have anything good to say. So I turned around, and I was like, fuck you, Julie Anderson.
Whoa.
And I got thrown out of class for it. Uh-huh. They were like, you go to the principal's office and you tell them what you just said. And I'm like, do I swear back at the principal? Or I didn't really care at the time because I got to miss band class. But that's what I think of when I think of band.
I think you have a lot of these rare instances where you get really angry, John.
Sometimes.
Ryan Daniels, can't believe you guys aren't watching Z True Long Island Story. Ryder is comedy gold in the show and even occasionally makes light of his position in WWE. Example, in episode 9, he's been having trouble climbing a fence, and when he's asked about what he's doing, he says, I'm trying to get over. Another one sees him performing random banal jobs to emphasize that he's doing all the jobs in WWE. Even the obvious with him wearing a WWE t-shirt and dropping a basketball with the Zack Ryder photo attached, the implication being obvious. There's also regular appearances by the Big O, Scott Stanford, being corny as ever, Broski of the Week, and more. Come on, guys, walk on the wild side and take a leap into Z, True Long Island Story.
Yeah, I've watched it a couple of times. It's not at the top of my priority every week to listen to the next Zack Ryder video, but I find it amusing now that, I don't know if you've watched SmackDown lately, but they've reintroduced Johnny Curtis, who won NXT Season 4, and last week he said...
Who the fuck is that?
Exactly. So he does his promo,
Johnny Curtis,
where he spills milk and then he starts crying to make the connection, oh, I'm crying over spilt milk. And then this week he puts a potato chip on his shoulder.
What, like he just comes out and does this?
He does it backstage.
Okay,
so he's got a chip on his shoulder. So they're taking all these clever little things.
But what does this have to do with anything?
Nothing. He just does like 30-second spots each week.
He's crying over spilt milk, and he has a chip on his shoulder. Like, are these even character traits? Like with Ryder?
Well, he said he's upset because he won NXT, but he's not getting his tag title shot as was promised for winning the season. And he hasn't been on TV all these months.
Oh, okay. Well, that's too bad that they're ripping off his gimmick.
Let's keep going here.
Robert Tonkinson.
I'll leave this here now and hope you guys look over this, as living in the UK, I won't be up to leave feedback after Raw. I've recently got back into wrestling after a 2-year hiatus, and the Law and Review Away episodes have helped reignite a passion. One person who has really got me interested is R-Truth, whose character actually is really interesting and clever. I enjoy how Truth has become a heel, but his character has the same aspects as before. As a face, he wrapped his theme to the ring with the fans and was a man for them. Now he may resent the fans, but he is still trying to be a role model for them, just being a heel in the process, almost like Punk preaching his straight edge philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Finally, from Stanley Ipkiss.
Yes.
Regarding the feedback on the end of Review of Raw, not sure if Way has ever seen the movie The Mask. Stanley Ipkiss was played by Jim Carrey. Of all the names I've heard, I think it's the most awesome. Stanley Ipkiss. Therefore, it's my pseudonym for Facebook groups. It's far more interesting than my actual name. It was a shame that John's attention was diverted during the reading of my feedback. Sorry, I wasn't paying attention, is what John said. Love the show, guys. You helped me get through my work day. All the best. I've seen The Mask. I would not be able to tell you the name of any character in that movie, though.
You should have known.
I should have known. How could we have missed?
Come on. He was a Prominent character.
Oh, boy.
1994 classic.
I don't know. I'm, you know.
How do you do that? How can you have an alias just for groups on Facebook?
He just made a new account, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah, I guess so.
Maybe he's embarrassed to be a member of our group.
I guess so. I guess he doesn't want to attach his name to the Review Away Nation.
It's okay.
So that's going to wrap up our feedback, everyone. For next week's show, I kind of just made an open poll. So I didn't put any candidates up for what we should review and just let you guys add what you wanted and see what wins. And Wade, you have the poll there. Should we confirm? I believe I know what it's going to be, but let's double check in case there was a last-minute surge in votes.
And the poll, we opened up, to all the various options. And should we run down the options?
Sure. Read some of them.
Starting from the very bottom, we're talking one.
I like how they sort them in order of votes.
Yeah, we're talking one vote here.
Yeah.
Santa with muscles.
Which we've reviewed, haven't we? Did we review that one?
I think we did. I don't remember. We've done too many.
We did.
Nitro, May 27th, 1996. That also received just one vote.
I think that was Scott Hall's debut.
Yeah. With another one voter, In Your House, Canadian Stampede.
It's a great pay-per-view.
Maybe that was a late addition, perhaps. Another one voter, WCW Bash at the Beach, 1999, featuring Sting and Savage. Sting
show.
And Nash versus Sid and Savage. I'll just read some of the other ones. TNA Sacrifice 2007, Vengeance 2001, WrestleMania 7 with 5 votes, WCW Uncensored 96.
Ooh, one of the worst main events in history.
Mega Powers versus Alliance to end Hulkamania in a triple cage. That received 7 votes. King of the Ring 2000 with 16 votes. JCW Bloody Mania 4 with 13 votes.
Wow.
SummerSlam 1992 with 56 votes, and the winner, Beyond the Mat, with 76 votes.
Wow. So Beyond the Mat is the winner, everybody. So we will review that next week, and I believe it will be the 500th time I've watched Beyond the Mat. But this will be a proactive viewing because we'll be discussing it afterwards. So we'll take a look at Beyond the Mat next week. And as always, everybody, we'll be back Tuesday with Review of Raw, Friday with Review and Impact. And as you can probably tell, me and Wei, we're experimenting with some things on the podcast, trying to add some more interactive elements and trying to make things more live for when we do Raw and Impact and stuff. So we're still tweaking some stuff, and we encourage anyone to, if you have some suggestions, interviews you'd like to hear us do, maybe if you want us to have more guests on these shows, feel free. Any feedback, positive or negative, changes you'd like to see us implement, just post it on the wall at facebook.com/reviewaway or facebook.com/liveaudiowrestling. We obviously check both of those. And we'll end off here with a tune, Wei, and I guess it will be your pick here for a song to go out with.
Oh, let's go out with Lex Luger's theme from 1989.
All right, here we go. Lex Luger, totally 80s.